Hey, deserving listeners, it's time to continue watching The Forensic Psychologist for Amber Heard. Let's watch. My name is Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and a professor. Let's watch.
So like I said, there are opinions embedded within them, but the main opinion is that Ms. Heard's report of intimate partner violence and the records that I reviewed is consistent with what we know in the field about intimate partner violence, characterized by physical violence, psychological aggression, sexual violence, coercive control, and surveillance behaviors.
All right, so there's the opinion. I'm guessing we're going to get some detail on that. I'm really curious as to what she's basing that on, because if she has solid data, then that will be very interesting. I think she's also saying that it wasn't mutual, meaning that Amber Heard didn't abuse him.
That we evaluated to see how they affected her emotionally and psychologically, and it was my determination that they did.
And did you arrive at any diagnostic conclusions?
Yes, I did.
And what were those?
So I'm just going to take a guess. I made this guess when we heard Dr. Curry's testimony that there is going to be no personality disorder because people believe that personality disorders are associated with crime and lying, which they are not. I mean, they certainly can be, but anyone can commit a crime and anyone can lie. And we're going to hear absolute PTSD as a result of Johnny Depp's trauma of her.
I diagnosed Ms. Heard with post-traumatic stress disorder.
And what, if any...
So that's it. And, you know, okay. Dr. Curry said one thing. Dr. Hughes is saying another thing. We all just have to make the call as the audience as to who we will trust.
So the etiology is the cause. In order to have to meet criteria for a post-traumatic stress disorder, you have to have an actual cause. It's one of the few diagnostic entities that we have to have a cause for. And the cause was the intimate partner violence by Mr. Depp. That was what was pushing the symptoms. That was what's related to the intrusive phenomena.
Okay, now maybe she has some solid basis for making that claim. But for me, when I treat people with borderline and histrionic, I almost always find, if not always find, indications of what one could call PTSD. Actually, I had a client once that was fired from his job, and he suffered from borderline. That was a huge rejection, right? And it was a job that he really loved. He was really, really, really dedicated to this job. It was very important to him. And one day, they just call him into the office and say, "We're firing you because budget things or something." It was completely out of the blue for him. He thought these people were his colleagues and friends, and you know, it really hurt his feelings. And so because of his past traumas, he became extremely symptomatic. In the borderline language, we would refer to it as having emotional dysregulation and having your abandonment trauma triggered, that kind of thing. But in PTSD language, the borderline person has a spike in distress. They will have a hard time thinking straight. They'll have a hard time making decisions. They'll have trouble sleeping. They might have nightmares. They might hole up in their apartment for a week because they're just trying to avoid the world, because they just feel completely separate and disjointed and despondent and demoralized from life. They might become suicidal. So that's all true for PTSD and for borderline.
It was related to her avoidance. That was related to her differences in her mood. That was related to her avoidance efforts. So it was the cause was the intimate partner violence by Mr. Depp.
Right. So she said what I imagined was behind that she looked at what she was being triggered by, what she would avoid as evidence as to what the genesis of the PTSD was.
If you need to consult your notes to answer something, let us know that you need to consult your notes. Otherwise, try to answer to the best of your ability. And then if you need to do that, just let us know you're consulting your notes, okay? The concern is that you not read from them, that you consult them as you need to, okay?
Correct. I just don't want this to be a memory test of having conducted many documents, 80 pages of notes, and 12 psychological testings to...
Yeah, this is something that actually really bothers me about forensic psychology, perhaps one of the minor reasons why I didn't want to do this job. In court, you are supposed to speak off the top of your head, and in psychological evaluations, you remember Dr. Curry talking about just the MMPI report that she wrote was 25 pages, so her full report must have been, I don't know, 50 pages, maybe 75 pages. She has to memorize all that. You know, remember when she was being asked about what was the T-score, and she said, "I don't remember." At the time, I thought, well, that's a pretty critical bit of data that you should be able to bring up. Perhaps she didn't want to bring it up because she knew that they were below 65 and didn't want to get into a debate. I said it back then that we would have to know how far below 65, like if it was 64, for example, and with the elevated case scale, you could conceivably make a judgment call that all the scales have to be increased because of the subduing of one's symptoms. But anyway, I remember thinking like, well, she probably can't answer that definitively because she doesn't remember. You know, if she takes a guess, you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to be precise, and yet you can't look at your report. Why not? Especially when it's stuff like this.
You can reference your notes, just don't read from them, okay?
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, great. So please tell us what documents you reviewed.
Yeah, and that's just so dumb. Like, you can reference your notes, but you can't read them. Why can't I read them? If you ask me what the 3-6 code type elevation scores were, and I say, oh, well, I see here that the T score was 64, you're not supposed to do that? Like, it's, I don't know.
So it was really helpful to talk to these two clinicians who really were with Ms. Hurd throughout the duration of her relationship with Mr. Depp. So they give us sort of a contemporaneous look at what was going on for her emotionally. And then what was she reporting? What was she saying about the relationship to her therapist?
100%. You should also talk to the couple therapists.
How many psychological assessments you administered to Amber Hurd?
I administered 12.
Can you please tell the jury which ones you administered?
So I am going to refer to my designation that has the list so that I don't forget anything.
Right. Like, how could you possibly remember? I mean, maybe you could remember all 12, but what if you got one wrong? Even the MMPI, you know, when Dr. Curry was talking about the MMPI, I mean, there are so many results that test will spit out. Now, of course, I'm not a legal expert. I'm not a lawyer. Maybe some of you know why you can't use, I don't know. I don't know. What would be the problem? You know, because the other thing that I don't like, because I've actually been on a jury, you're not allowed to take notes as a juror. And I'm thinking, wouldn't you want us to take notes? I mean, there's so many different details to keep track of. And the way our memory works, we often just remember the last thing we heard. So especially if the trial takes place over 6 months or a few weeks, I mean, I'm sure there's some reason. I could think of a couple of reasons as to why you wouldn't want that. But couldn't you account for that? You know, can't the pros outweigh the cons?
So I administered...
Objection, hearsay, Your Honor.
She can refresh her recollection.
As long as she's not reading it.
Right. You just can't read. You're not supposed to read.
It's maddening. Technically, she can look at her notes, download the information into her head, and then state it. But she can't read her notes. So you couldn't even possibly remember all 12, even for a little bit. So you're supposed to, I guess, look at three, dedicate it to short-term memory, state the three. Can I please refer to my notes again? Okay. I mean, that's just so dumb.
From it, but you can refresh your recollection as you're speaking.
So I can look and just look up, and that's refreshing my recollection? Okay.
All right, if we could approach for a moment.
I would have that face down, just like, really? I'm just going to read 12 tests.
This is the personality assessment inventory, which is a broadband instrument.
Okay, they're focusing on Dr. Curry in the audience, the camera. Who is working the camera? Because they actually scanned the whole audience, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. We're getting close up on the people in the pews. You call them pews? They look like pews. I didn't show it, but Dr. Curry's like looking out of the corner of her eye. She's like, is the camera on me? And now she's like, great. Now I'm on camera. She's saying, Dr. Hughes is saying she used the PAI, which I referred to earlier as an alternative to the MPI-2 that some people use.
And to scan for psychopathology and psychological symptoms that people have. I administered the trauma symptom inventory too.
That's the other instrument I referred to that is a very common. I don't know what the percentage of forensic psychologists will use this, but it's the first one that I go to, the TSI-2. So what Dr. Curry would say is that, well, if you administer a symptom inventory and someone wants to fake, then they will. They can just check off that they have all the symptoms and it will spit out a PTSD diagnosis. So if someone's malingering, it's not going to detect that.
Which is an instrument to scan for common traumatic effects that people have. I administered the Miller Forensic Assessment of Symptoms test, which is a measure of malingering.
Okay, so she did administer a malingering test.
administered the post-traumatic stress disorder checklist for the fifth edition for the DSM-5. I administered the clinician-administered PTSD scale for DSM-5.
So she administered two checklists, essentially, to really make sure that the individual qualifies for the PTSD diagnosis.
I administered the Beck Depression Inventory, the Beck Anxiety Inventory.
So those are two really common tests as well. They're very short, and you ask the client to fill them out. It takes maybe 5 minutes. It's very easy, and it very quickly assesses depression and anxiety.
The mood disorders questionnaire, the danger, I did three intimate partner violence measures, the conflict tactic scale, the abusive behavior observation checklist, and the danger assessment scale.
Okay, so she administered three intimate partner violence measures. I'm going to guess at least one of them has a validity component, meaning that it tests for malingering. I don't know, though, because I haven't used those instruments. But okay, that's interesting.
And then I also did the life events checklist, which scans and gets us to ask about a lot of traumatic events that an individual may have experienced. And we administer that typically before either doing the PCL or doing the CAPS.
I'm curious as to why she didn't do the MMPI-2, which is the standard, but certainly the PAI is a viable alternative. And in some ways, I like the PAI. But yeah, so that's great. PAI, some trauma measures, a malingering measure. Also, the PAI has validity indexes that measure if someone is feigning or malingering. I'm trying to think what else I would have used. I like the MCMI. I mentioned that earlier, that assesses for personality disorders. It's not incredibly accurate. It spits out results that can absolutely not be found when you actually interview people over time. But if you're on the Amber Heard side, you might actually not want to administer that because it often has false positives. So I'm trying to think what else. Well, the CAPS-5 would have been appropriate in the same way that Dr. Curry said that it helps to detect whether or not someone is feigning or not, because the interview protocol really gets into depth. It requires the individual to produce the symptoms from their own experience rather than just checking off on a checklist. So, yeah, I mean, it's certainly a good set of instruments that she used, especially because it has the malingering instrument in there.
The MFAS, the Miller Assessment, a Forensic Assessment of Symptoms test, is a specific malingering instrument. It looks at malingering psychopathology. Is this someone, you know, malingering psychopathology? She scored a 0 on that scale. So on that test.
Okay, so what does that tell us? Well, it's a strong indication that Amber Heard wasn't malingering, but it's not a guarantee. Certainly someone could even study that test. You could also just be extremely sophisticated in your understanding of what the test is trying to get at and thus avoid answering in a way that indicates that you're feigning or malingering.
On the TSI, there are two validity indices, and she scored within the normal range on those scores as well. One was slightly elevated, but when in testing the limits, because it has rare symptoms and over-endure symptoms, I determined that that also was a valid measure.
She's saying that the indices of validity on the TSI-2 indicated that she was within normal limits. However, one was slightly elevated, but she determined based on, you know, a closer look that it indicated that Amber Heard's responses were not feigning or malingering. But that's interesting, and I commend her for mentioning that. She didn't have to mention that. She could have, maybe she expects under cross that will come up, but I don't think so. I'll commend her for mentioning that. That adds to her believability.
And then finally, the PAI, the large scale 344 question instrument, has very robust validity scales on it to test for exaggeration or feigning or malingering, and she did not score in any of those scores and those scales at all. Those were not elevated.
On all three instruments, no indication of malingering or feigning. Yeah. I mean, that says a lot. It really does. But on the MAPI-2, with Dr. Curry, she had an elevated K scale, so there's that. But we didn't hear about elevations in any of the other validity scales on MAPI-2. What does that all mean? If I heard that and heard nothing else, if I heard the results of the TSI-2 and the symptom checklist and the CAPS-5 and the MMPI-2 and the PAI and the malingering test, if I heard all of that together, I would think I would really need to look at the CAPS-5's results because all that is written down. And that would be the kicker, because if there wasn't a strong signal of feigning on the CAPS-5, then I would say, well, I mean, you have all the other symptoms, you have the validity scales, even on the TSI-2, PAI responses were valid. Well, I don't know. I mean, with the possible 3-6 code type, I would wonder if the defensiveness and subduing of one's symptoms and potentially even lack of insight affecting all, especially the self-report instruments. And I did run into this when I would do this sort of work, that I would see someone with profile where they just seem to be unaware or in denial. You know, we understand that, right? If you're suffering a lot, or you weren't given a chance to really develop a connection with your emotions and your needs when you're young, you could be 35 and have tremendous psychopathology, but really have no awareness of it. Because when it pops up, one, you either deny that it's happening or you blame it on something else, or once it's over, you just quickly try to forget it because it's overwhelming and you don't have any way of processing that. And you have this really helpful defense of just moving on with your life and assuming everything is fine because you feel trapped and you feel like to acknowledge it would be just to feed the monster, so to speak. So I don't know what I'd think. I think I would, if that's all I heard, I think I would assume the person had PTSD. When you ask people about their PTSD symptoms, sometimes that can trigger them, and they know that, so they actually avoid going into depth about their PTSD symptoms because they know from experience that to fully remember those experiences, which is to throw yourself into a week of panic and distress and symptoms. You kind of wish that you had like a third psychologist that was hired by the judge, for example, or was a government employee that just came in and assessed both of them, wasn't hired by either one and didn't care what either legal team thought of them. You know, it's like, why don't we have that? Wouldn't that make more sense?
And then importantly, on this test specifically, it says, do not use the percentile rank. It is in the manual, it is in italics, because the way that this test was normed, it was normed on people who have trauma. So it's what we call negatively skewed. That means it falls on the tail end of the continuum. It is not a normal curve where we would normally think of how a percentile would work. So you would not use the percentile rank on this test.
That sounds credible, though, what she's saying. But hearing what her rebuttal is to Dr. Curry, it still sounds like the ATR found exaggeration of symptoms, and I forgot about that one, actually. Oh, she said that if someone's in distress, then you will get a false positive of feigning, which, yeah, absolutely. And that's why, you know, you take everything into account. So it all comes down to the CAPS-5, because if that shows clear indication of feigning and a lack and evidence that Amber Heard did not actually have any details on what actual symptoms felt like, then I would understand Dr. Curry's findings. But if it's in the gray zone, then yeah, it's and this is why, that's another reason why I didn't want to do this work, because I would love to just provide my actual opinion, but I can't do that because I would never get hired again. And no one ever told me that, but I just inferred that from my experience. So I don't want to accuse the industry of somehow being dubious, but I didn't want to be beholden to the legal team that hired me. And of course, we aren't ethically or professionally, but if I contradict them or I don't give them what they want, I think the chance of me getting hired again by that legal team is small. Who knows? I'm just putting that out. Because if I were in these shoes and I actually had all the data from both forensic psychologists and you put me on the stand, I would say, I don't know. There's indications she absolutely has PTSD. There's also indications that she might not. She might be really good at faking it. I can't tell. How in the world am I supposed to tell? I'm not a mind reader. No one is. There's no such thing as a lie detector. We have these tests that can detect feigning, but they're not foolproof, and a sophisticated person could trick it. Like, I could trick it because I know what these tests, how they're designed. I don't know if I could trick the MMPI-2, though.
So that is a very inaccurate way to describe that scale and that test. And so the ATR scale on this test is probably the least robust of our validity scales, so you would never make a comment like that based on one scale if you don't have consistency across data.
Well, she did. She had other data. The data she most cited was the CAPS-5 data, so I'm guessing she's going to get at that.
And when you look at the consistency across the testing with the PAI, the TSI, and the MFAS, and there's research to support that, that when they go together, you have a higher degree of likelihood that this is not feigned PTSD, that this is not feigned symptomatology.
Right. So, as I've been saying from the beginning, if she has PTSD, doesn't mean that she wasn't abusive. It doesn't mean that she didn't have at least the precursor, if not the full-blown diagnosis, prior to ever meeting Johnny Depp, and her relationship with Johnny Depp just exacerbated it. So being hung up on whether or not she has PTSD or not, at least to me, it really doesn't mean anything.
And then actually, if I look at the validity scores on the MMPI-2 that Dr. Curry administered, those scales are not elevated for exaggeration or malingering either.
Right, exactly. That's what I was saying earlier, because there's several validity scales on the MMPI-2. And if you were being unbiased or you weren't hired by other team, you would report on all those validity scales. You'd say, well, these 8 indicated honest answers and non-exaggeration and non-subduing, but this one validity scale does have some elevation. So here's how I interpret that. And I hope it actually is kind of clear, if you are watching me react to all this, that there's a lot of art form in forensic psychology. It's claimed to be a science, but clearly if 2 professionals can find completely different things, then, you know, because if 2 scientists study what components are in a diamond, one's not going to find it's made out of carbon and the other one's going to find it's made out of oxygen, for example. There might be some slight percentage differences, but it's going to be mostly carbon, right? And if you have 10 scientists, they're all going to find that that diamond is made out of carbon. That's hard science. In forensic psychology and psychology at large, there's a lot of art form to it. There's a lot of subjectivity. There's a lot of opinion. There's a lot of bias. There's a lot of your own personal experience or your own professional needs, that kind of thing. To have these individuals on the stand is interesting, but it just has to be considered with all that in mind, right? Because it's not like this is an anomaly. Each team could hire 10 other psychologists, and in all likelihood, the findings would fall out by who hired who. That should just tell us something. And to me, it's an indictment on the profession that you would have such... We can never know if either one of these psychologists are biased, right? They could both be completely honest. One could be right, one could be wrong. They both could be looking at the data and interpreting it to their best ability, completely unaffected by who hired them. We can't know that. But if I were not in the profession and I didn't know much about the profession, I looked at it, I'd be like, this is just a sham. You're just finding things that the client wants you to find because you're being hired by them. You know, it'd be like if you're a scientist working for the cigarettes company and you find that cigarettes don't cause cancer, which happened back in the day. And we all understand that's massive. It's an example of corruption, I guess, when you think about it. And because it's so normalized, because it's so common and so usual in courtrooms, it just becomes, well, yeah, I mean, that's what happens. And I just think it needs an overhaul. I actually do not believe that either one of these forensic psychologists is lying at all. And if my lawyer were here, she would say, make sure you mention that. but I honestly believe it. So just kind of frustrating.
Add that, now I have really robust data that Ms. Heard is not malingering or feigning her psychological symptomatology.
Right. To summarize what she's saying is, even when you consider Dr. Curry's test results, there is a lot of data indicating that Amber Heard was not lying during the test taking. Absolutely.
Thank you. Did you administer any tests that are specific to domestic violence?
Yes, I did.
Now, I'm really curious what the PAI found, because similar to MMPI-2, it's hard to fake that, but maybe a little easier anecdotally than MMPI-2. But there are scales for borderline, for example, specifically, actually, because PAI was developed.
I would like to refer to the testing.
To refresh your recollection?
To refresh my recollection, just a glance, so
yes,
I can be clear with the jury.
So she's being asked to report on some extremely important data points, three tests regarding intimate partner violence. She asks to look at her notes, and the other legal team is all upset. Maybe it's like, well, Dr. Curry couldn't look at her notes, so how come she's being allowed to look at her notes? Okay, double standard. But let's just let them all look at their notes. Now, I will say that I think all three of these measures are self-report. So just taking a guess that the questions would be something like, do you feel safe, or have you ever felt unsafe? How often do you worry that if you don't make them happy, they will hurt you? You know, things like that. So if you wanted to lie, it wouldn't be hard because it's clear from the questions what they're getting at. Having said all that, I could see a scenario where Amber Heard absolutely, if we were there, a fly in the wall, invisible, watching, there were moments where we would think that's abuse. Johnny Depp just abused Amber Heard. But if it was mutual abuse, then would we say that Amber Heard was accurate in her statement in the Washington Post, characterizing herself as an abuse victim? I mean, yeah, right? Like, if it was mutual abuse, you could say you just left out the part that you were also abusive.
So what the overall gist of the testing was that, and the benefit of these tests is that they allow me to ask for what Mr. Depp did to Ms. Heard, and then also what Ms. Heard did to Mr. Depp. So it was asking about both sets of behavior.
From Amber Heard. So if you're trying to determine if intimate partner violence happened, you would ask Johnny Depp to fill these out as well, right? Because if you're an abuser, you are likely not to report that you abuse. So what she's saying is that she's asking for what she incurred and what she did to Johnny Depp as well. But it's all self-report. So how could you possibly know if someone was lying or not? And the feigning and malingering tests are for psychopathology, not for intimate partner violence. The measures that she provided are there to assess if someone is trying to fake if they have schizophrenia or depression or PTSD. They're not there to determine if someone is generally lying during the evaluation, right? In terms of the test results, it's interesting. But if the whole trial is about the possibility of Amber Heard lying, then, you know, it just doesn't really help much at all, actually.
And objection, Your Honor. We're back to reading.
She wasn't even looking down. She was looking at the jury.
Go ahead.
Please continue.
So what these tests show was that there was a high degree of serious violence perpetrated by Mr. Depp toward Ms. Heard. There was violence more on the mild level perpetrated by Ms. Heard toward Mr. Depp with one severe indication.
Okay, but that wouldn't be the way I would describe it. I would describe it the way Dr. Curry worded things like this, which would be, I can't comment on whether or not abuse happened. I can tell you that this test indicated that she responded in a way that indicated that Johnny Depp was abusing her, but I can't say if it actually happened because I wasn't there, and that's not our job as forensic psychologists.
Indicator, which was the punching that she indicated to me. There were scales about negotiation, about how much this couple tries to figure out their problems. They both scored, again, this is Ms. Heard reporting that, but they both scored in the high range.
The other thing I'll mention is that it's well known in intimate partner violence treatment circles, meaning among colleagues, that abusers, especially as time goes on, because they start to learn the system, everyone has Google, that the abusers will learn how to language things to make it seem like they're the actual victim. And they're able sometimes to very easily get out of being accused of domestic violence because they know what to say. When the police arrive, say they're, you know, the abusive person is abusing someone, the victim calls the police, they sometimes, not usually, to be honest, but sometimes will know exactly what to say when the police arrive, maybe even know how to provoke the victim to having an emotional breakdown. And then the police arrive and they see a calm, cool, collected person saying, I don't know what's happening. I don't know what to say because I've never been in that position. But it's well understood that they might become really quite sophisticated in their ability to trick evaluators, police officers, the justice system.
Serious violence perpetrated by Mr. Depp toward Ms. Heard. There was violence more on the mild level perpetrated by Ms. Heard toward Mr. Depp with...
That actually lends itself to more believability from everything here, Amber Heard and Dr. Hughes, that from the sound of it, Amber Heard on the tests disclosed that she had been violent to Johnny Depp. Well, I mean, you could argue that a sophisticated liar would know to include some things to make it seem like it is more accurate and then just couch it as defensive or situational. Now, I've been saying this from the beginning. We could be looking at a situation where Johnny Depp is abusive. And if we were there, we would see absolutely that Amber Heard 99% of the time was a victim. She might also have a personality disorder or be on some sort of spectrum, but that doesn't mean she can't be a victim.
Mr. Depp engaged in more severe acts of psychological aggression, whereas Ms. Heard did engage in also some mild and severe acts of psychological aggression.
According to Amber Heard's responses, it indicated that both engaged in severe psychological aggression. The way that she worded it was some mild and some severe. But essentially, what we're hearing is that Amber Heard admitted that she was psychologically abusive to him and him to her.
The amount of injury that was reported was significantly higher and more severe by Ms. Heard, what she was subjected to. And then she was subjected to sexual violence where Mr. Depp, based on her.
The way she's wording it is not the way I was taught to word things. She literally just said, Johnny Depp sexually abused Amber Heard. Let's rewind that. I mean, she's been saying a number of things along these lines, but how could you possibly say that? I mean, with all the objections on hearsay, that is one of the biggest hearsay moments you got. And the test does not show that. The test does not show this person was sexually assaulted. All it says is this is what they reported. In the same way that if someone tells you in a session that they were sexually assaulted, that's all you know is that they told you. You can believe them, and you probably should if you're a therapist, but you don't know it happened. You just know that that's what they told you. So that confusion, and I've never heard a forensic psychologist say something like that, just flat out. Yes. I mean, it'd be like a forensic psychologist being on the stand saying that person did, in fact, embezzle money. I mean, if forensic psychologists could say that, imagine what they would be saying on the stand. And again, maybe there'll be an object. Let's rewind that.
Mild and severe acts of psychological aggression. The amount of injury that was reported was significantly higher and more severe by Ms. Heard, what she was subjected to. And then she was subjected to sexual violence where Mr. Depp, based on her report, was subjected to none.
Okay, so then at the very end, she sneaks in, her report was.
And then the other, on the danger assessment scale, that there were a number of factors that were related to severity in violent relationships and a risk factor. When we look, as I said earlier, when behaviors come up on this scale, they're very worrisome, very scary, and we have to take them seriously. So there were a number of behaviors that came up on this scale, such as Mr. Depp threatens to kill her, the increase in severity of the abuse, the forced sexual activity.
Again, reported. It's reported to you. If a client of mine came to me and reported that to me, it would be a very serious disclosure that I would take very seriously. And unless I had some weird reason to believe they were lying to me, I would absolutely believe them. And I would go with that. Absolutely. But this is different. Like, you can't. You weren't there. And, you know, people lie, especially when they know you're going to go on the stand.
The choking behavior, his obsessive jealousy.
Objection, foundation.
Talking about the test results.
Overruled, go ahead.
Please continue.
It's not test results. The test results are, this is what was reported to the self-report test. So this is why someone has to, I hope cross-examine does this, but that if the jury believes, because you could imagine someone believing that this test definitively tests whether or not someone was abused. That's the way that she's describing it. That's not what the test is there to do. It's there to assess what someone is telling, and it gives a good idea, it gives an indication. It would be hard to lie about all those things, but people could lie about all those things. So, I mean, unless I'm missing something, I've never used those instruments, so I can't talk about that with a lot of precision and expertise, but she did say that they were self-report measures and that they didn't have validity scales on them.
The obsessive jealousy, the control aspect, and his threatening of suicide to kill himself. So those were risk factors that placed her in the increased danger range. And this is a range that, you know, says that we certainly have to advise women of their risk and consult with law enforcement if they're involved or judges if they're involved.
Right, exactly. That's, in my experience, that's typically how these measures are utilized in an assessment of someone, whether they come in saying I'm a victim of domestic violence or you suspect, you might administer these tests as a way of gauging the danger level to guide what the next steps should be. It'd be a similar test as to suicide assessment, because with suicide risk, you want to determine where they are, how imminently at risk they are of attempting, so that you can appropriately respond to reduce the likelihood of them killing themselves. If they are low risk, then there's not an emergency. There are recommendations for that, like ongoing therapy, monitoring the suicidal ideation. If they're imminently at risk, then you have to seek hospitalization right away, that sort of thing. With domestic violence inventories, it's a similar thing. You're looking at, is this person experiencing any sort of violence and coercion and abuse? And if so, how much is the risk? Because people get killed. When victims come in and access services, it is a potential risk of them actually being murdered. That happens, where the abuser's like, oh crap, I'm gonna lose control of this person because now they're contacting professionals. I'm gonna take them out and kill myself. It happens. It happened to a colleague of mine, actually. So that's why you need to really make sure, because it is a matter of life and death, that you understand as a clinician where the risk is and the severity of the abuse and the scope of it. And if you just interview someone, you might not catch all of the different factors. Plus, these instruments sometimes can be done in a pretty short amount of time and you get a lot of data from it rather than asking a bunch of questions. You would, of course, ask a bunch of questions. And I used to do this work back in the day. We had an instrument. I can't remember what it was called, but it was along these lines. And yeah, absolutely. You would tend to believe that, because why would someone lie to you about that? And you wouldn't want to question someone, because what if you're wrong and they go home and they get murdered or further abused? So you err on the side of caution, for sure, in intimate partner violence treatment.
Because this means that a woman is at risk for more serious or lethal domestic violence.
All right, well, that does it for that episode. Everyone out there, please take care of yourself, because you deserve it. You really, really do.